Morning, friends. Though perhaps apocryphal, there is a wonderful anecdote about Oscar Wilde, who is reputed, upon exiting from a party, to have turned and said, "If there is anyone here who I have not offended, I sincerely apologize." Well, I am no Oscar Wilde. Rather, at the end of the week, I feel the need to apologize to those I have offended. Some of you have expressed concern over my use of the word Quakerism, others over my use of the term God, and I'm sure there have been other insensibilities in my remarks as well. Let me just say, I'm listening, I'm learning. I have to say. I began the week with the Bible on Monday, reading Jesus' relationship to the law as one of neither obedience nor disobedience, but of fulfillment. I followed that with a reading of early Quakerism as taking up a relationship to the Christianity of its day as reiterating this relationship. That is, as one that was neither a straightforward adherence nor a rejection of Christianity, but an attempt at its fulfillment. In the third lecture, I attempted, having recourse to turf closer to my own, to provide what might be called a loose philosophical analysis of this structure of fulfillment, relabeling it radicalizing spirit, suggesting that human life, both at an individual and a group level, traces out a structure that parallels it. Yesterday, I explored how we might understand the thorny issue of the contemporary relationship between Quakerism and Christianity by reading it through this lens, in an attempt to provide a theoretical scaffolding upon which to understand the Quaker movement as, to borrow the phrase of Ashworth and Wildwood, rooted in Christianity, open to new light. I want today to conclude by returning to the Bible, to trace out once more this structure of fulfillment or radicalizing spirit, this time with respect to the crucial issue of knowledge. I do so because what we think we know is often at the bottom of what divides us. Orthodox friends claim to know what has been revealed to them in the scriptures and contextualize whatever other knowledge claims are made across experience or science in light of that, whereas modern liberal friends tend toward trusting their own experience as the basis of what they claim to know religiously, although this is usually taken as being quite tentative, and rely upon the powers of human reason, that is, science, for the knowledge of everything else. Religious claims that don't pass the muster of these tests are suspect, which is most of them. If what we know divides us, perhaps we need to rethink knowledge in light of a radicalizing spirit. Perhaps knowledge itself needs to be fulfilled. I want to suggest that this is precisely what Paul attempts to do in his first letter to the Corinthians. Indeed, I would propose that this structure of fulfillment that I am also referring to with the more Quakerly resonant locution, radicalizing spirit, is not an occasional thing in the Christian scriptures, popping up here and there, but is all pervasive, is the very dynamic of the gospel itself. If that is true, the gospel is not used but abused when it is taken to prop up one side of an ideological struggle and to demonize the other side. Orthodox and liberal friends are both guilty of this, as am I. Rather, what the structure of fulfillment offers is the promise of life for all, beyond the morally lazy practice of dividing the world up between the white hats and the black hats, toward what some have described, and not so badly, I think, as a radical third way. Neither this nor that, but something else. Something that gets us unstuck, not polarized, but energized. To encounter the gospel, then, to read it as a promise, is to be open to being surprised. The good news, as the name suggests, is something new. Specifically, not the same old thing. Specifically, not what is expected. In order, then, to hear the gospel, to really hear it, with ears to hear, is to be attuned to the promise of fulfillment. We have already seen this at work in the opening lecture. When confronted by the man with the withered hand, planted by the Pharisees to trip him up, Jesus does not follow the straight line of the law and refuse to work on the Sabbath, but rather heals the man. But this Jesus does not refer to as breaking the law, as do the Pharisees, who see only two options at this point, either to keep the law or to violate it. Jesus claims instead neither to have kept nor broken the law, but to have fulfilled it. The Pharisees didn't see that coming. But we find this same dynamic in many other biblical stories as well. When presented with the woman caught in adultery, another trap, to see if he would condemn her, as any straight-laced and straight-thinking Jewish rabbi would be compelled to do, Jesus slips the question of condemnation altogether, ignores the line that runs from sin to condemnation, and then and only after that to forgiveness. Rather, Jesus begins at the end with forgiveness, which changes not only the expected chronology of events, but transforms the events themselves. For here, where forgiveness is pronounced independently of confession, prior to confession, confession becomes possible because it is no longer the sinner's participation in his or her own condemnation, but the possibility of taking a fuller responsibility for the life now restored. The Pharisees didn't see that one coming either. That's fulfillment. When the disciples inform Jesus of the hunger of the crowds by the Sea of Galilee, the disciples' sage counsel was that the multitudes should be sent away to seek sustenance. But Jesus took and blessed and broke the contents of a boy's boxed lunch and transformed them into a feast for 5,000, with more to spare. The miraculous is the unexpected, the unanticipatable, and the unexpected itself is a miracle, a break with the necessary, which, far from being mere magic, is rather the deeper structure from which even the dream of magic takes its bearings. The line stretched between the options of staying and being hungry and going for food is transformed into neither, but into the filling, the fulfillment of all. Even the disciples didn't see that coming. For in the gospel, it is not merely that roads do not lead to anticipated destinations. They may not lead to destinations at all. Premises not only do not necessarily lead to logical conclusions, they sometimes lead to something entirely other than conclusions. And it is not only that even the straight arrows do not hit their intended targets. Arrows and targets are frequently configured into something else. Water becomes wine. One is not baptized with water, but with fire and the Holy Spirit. And swords are beaten into plowshares, which, before it is a task for the blacksmith, is a supreme exercise in imagination, in the miraculous. The supposedly straight lines that should lead from expectation to realization, the seeming logicality that draws us, perhaps inexorably, from anticipation to consummation, when exposed to the gospel, are often, not always, for that would make the unexpected expected again, but often, transformed into something else. How do we envision this? It's not exactly that the line that leads from A to B is eliminated. The law is not erased by Jesus. It is not that the expectations are disappointed exactly. It is more that they are reconfigured. It is rather that what is, the law, forgiveness, loaves and fishes, are revisioned in the light of a new perspective, are recontextualized to the point of becoming something other than what they previously were, becoming something entirely new. Behold, all things are become new, Paul writes. The gospel is revolutionary to the point of transforming, renewing reality itself, which is perhaps why in Acts there is talk of turning the world upside down, and perhaps why Christians can speak of being in but not of the world, not capitulating to the inevitabilities imposed by what is realistic. The gospel calls for expectation, hope, the realization of what is not the case. And perhaps the world that the Christian Bible opposes to the gospel is our inability or unwillingness to see and live expansively, to imagine a bigger picture. Perhaps the world is a narrowing, a reduction, the monotony of the same always following the same, the all is vanity of Ecclesiastes, over against the gospel that reforms, that incites and excites. Perhaps the world that is opposed to the gospel is no particular set of structures or practices, but capitulation in the face of the ineluctable necessity of law, or otherwise put, a lack of imagination, being closed to the Spirit of God. It is in this sense, perhaps, that the gospel opposes itself to the law. Not constrained by the expectations provided by the Sabbath legalities, nor by the psycho-juridical order of confession and forgiveness, nor by the physical laws of laws and fishes, the gospel is the promise of renewal because it is true to life, and life itself is unpredictable, and requires for living it well, that is, faithfully, imaginative work. If this were psychology, we'd be talking about a new gestalt. If theology, transcendence. If science, we'd be talking about a paradigm shift. If politics, revolution. And we are talking about all of these and more. What I want to suggest is that when it comes to the gospel's treatment of knowledge, we should not be surprised if we are surprised. Should not be surprised if our conventional expectations regarding knowledge are not also undermined and transformed in light of the gospel. This is, I propose, precisely what we find in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul's gorgeous hymn to love, which has a surprisingly lot to say about knowledge. I pick this passage because of its familiarity, because even if you are not a regular reader of the Bible, you've been to weddings, where it is regularly read, and appropriately so. For unlike Celine Dion's Titanic theme, or Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You, staples at weddings during their season, this chapter never becomes hackneyed. Although for the sake of my lecture today, I will focus on the later verses, 8 to 13, which focus on the function and fate of knowledge, I will read the whole chapter in the familiar locutions of the King James Version. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now I ask you to listen for the references to knowledge in what remains. Love never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Now we are dealing here with a knowledge that is partial, which is opposed to that which is perfect. We are dealing, we are dealing with an immature knowledge, which is opposed to a subsequent maturity. We are dealing with a seeing, which is at least a kind of knowledge, that is through a glass. The Greek word is enigmati, from which we get our word enigma. Seeing in darkness, that is a seeing poorly, which is opposed to seeing face to face. We are dealing yet again with a partial knowledge, which is this time opposed to a knowing as I am known. We are dealing, in short, with a movement cast eschatologically, that is, from what is the case to what is to be accomplished. On the side of what is the case, we find partial knowledge, childish understanding and thinking, seeing enigmatically, that is, in obscurity and in darkness, and then again, partial knowledge. Now, on our normal way of thinking, according to our expectations, we should expect these examples of insufficient knowledge to be completed by a fully sufficient or complete knowledge. We would expect partial knowledge to find its completion in full knowledge. We would expect childish knowledge to find its completion in adult knowledge. We would expect seeing through a glass darkly to find its completion in seeing clearly, and seeing in darkness to find its fulfillment by a seeing in perfect light. We would expect the repeat of partial knowledge to again find its fulfillment in total knowledge. But listen to what we do get. And notice that, with one exception, which we will have to discuss, the word knowledge does not appear in the list. In the place of partial knowledge, we do not get full knowledge, as we would normally expect, but the coming of the perfect. In the place of childish understanding and thinking, we do not get adult understanding and thinking, as we would normally expect, but becoming a man. In the place of seeing enigmatically and seeing in darkness, we do not get seeing clearly and in the light, as we would normally expect, but seeing face to face. In the place of partial knowledge, mentioned here the second time, our normal expectation of full knowledge is again is not what is promised, but rather knowing as I am known. That is, the expected trajectory running from partial to full knowledge, from knowing in part to knowing perfectly, is in this text subverted. Incomplete knowledge is not completed, fulfilled, perfected, in more or more perfect knowledge, but in something else altogether, something that is not knowledge at all and doesn't have to do with knowledge, at least not directly. The perfection of knowledge is not a supreme knowledge. Rather, the whole task of knowing is subverted and displaced by something that is not, in its turn, a matter of knowledge at all. Let me put this as startlingly as possible. The perfection of knowledge is precisely in its being overturned. As a philosopher, I didn't see that coming. But as readers of the gospel, as ones prepared to be on guard for the structure of fulfillment, we should not be entirely shocked, since already in verse 8, right before this new and unexpected trajectory is given, we were already told that knowledge would pass away. And if there was any question as to what it is that knowledge, under the auspices of the gospel, would evolve into as it comes to perfection, we are surely given the response in both the verse that precedes this revisioning of the trajectory of knowledge and in the one that follows. In both verses 8 and 13, the passing away of knowledge has as its context the non-passing away, the non-failure of love. And if this is the case, then two phrases in our passage can be more fully understood. What it means to see face to face, and what it means to know, even as I also am known. For recall that in lieu of our present enigmatic knowledge, the promise, the goal, is seeing face to face, which I am suggesting is not just another way of saying seeing clearly, but a revolutionary revisioning. Now, we are all familiar with the difference between knowing about someone and having knowledge about them and actually meeting them. I could take several hours to tell you everything I know about my mother, and then have her brother come in and do the same, to tell you things about my mother that would surprise even me. But even after several hours of instruction, if I were to ask you, "Do you know my mother?" most of you would have to say, "Well, I know a lot about your mother, but I don't know her. I've never met her." A face-to-face relationship is not one qualified by the knowledge of facts. It is not the relationship between a knowing subject and a known object. A face-to-face relationship is personal. It is a relationship between subjects, a two-way relationship, and one wherein the knowledge of each other is not about facts, but about intimacy. Face-to-face is the posture of intimacy, the posture of lovers, of interlocutors, and also the posture of combatants, which is why we can love God, speak with God, wrestle with God, as we can love our intimate, speak with our intimate, wrestle with our intimate, things that are impossible to do with mere things that we know about, because all of these require someone who will love and speak and wrestle back. And it is this relationship that the Bible refers to as knowing when it is using that term in its most important sense. When Adam knew his wife Eve and they conceived a child, they were not engaged in an intellectual exercise. This was a face-to-face relationship. This was intimate familiarity. And that is why the passage continues. "At present I know in part, but then I shall know fully, even as I am also known." The final goal here, eschatologically cast, is to know as I am known. And so knowledge is not entirely destroyed, even if the only knowledge that survives the passing away of knowledge is the kind that correlates to God's knowledge of me. And this knowledge, in turn, is best understood as the knowledge of the face-to-face, as a knowledge that is love. And why this discourse on knowledge is not out of place, in Paul's great hymn to love. Yes, God knows the number of hairs on my head, as the Gospel of Matthew attests, but not in the manner of some supercomputer, coldly and impassively tabulating and calculating, knowing for the sake of knowing. Rather, God knows the number of hairs on my head to glory in my development through infancy, to embrace me in my insecurities about balding and aging, and to love me through the chemotherapy that reduces the count to null. The facts by themselves are enigmatic, pointless, meaningless, passing away, open to any sense we might choose to project upon them. They only become knowledge in the only sense that the Bible cares about, on my view, when they are personal. The fullness of knowledge, its perfection or fulfillment, is not more facts, but intimacy, the personal, and an intimacy that transforms the very meaning of the facts themselves. Here then, in a remarkable turn, the fulfillment of knowledge is not omniscience, but love. And in light of this, our usual obsessions with getting it right are but a shadowy and ethereal distraction. And that is why, in the New Testament, not many wise are called. They are looking in the wrong place. And this is why Christian education and Quaker education, insofar as it affects its aspiration to fulfill Christianity, cannot be the mere learning of more or even different facts, but a knowing differently, in a different mode, by an entirely different measure. It is not that knowledge, as knowing about, is irrelevant, at least not at present, but we only participate in the Spirit of God when the end, that is the purpose, of our knowledge is love. And that is why neither theology nor science, and above all not philosophy, can be the key to knowledge. All of these are part of the in part, are what will pass away, in deference to the knowledge that is, in the end, love itself. And if we don't know that, if we don't know in that way, then it seems to me we have become, as the first verse of this chapter informs us, as but sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. I've been engaged this week in encouraging us as Quakers to know one another. And I have done a fair bit of theoretical work, probably too much, to provide a framework in which we might understand ourselves and other friends with whom we disagree on important matters as nevertheless fellow participants in the same radicalizing spirit that is the Quaker faith. What I hope to have suggested today is that this understanding, this knowledge, is only fulfilled as love. That, of course, is the hard part, but in the end, the only part that really matters, the only part that endures. Let me close the week with one of the British yearly meeting advices and queries that I suggest we think not only in the context of our own meetings, but as a way of approaching the larger body of friends. It says what I have been trying to say much better than I have been saying it, and in a single paragraph, and is, I think, a wonderful example of Quakerism as defined by William Penn, Christianity writ plain. How can we make the meeting a community in which each person is accepted and nurtured, and strangers are welcome? Seek to know one another in the things which are eternal. Bear the burden of each other's failings and pray for one another. As we enter with tender sympathy into the joys and sorrows of each other's lives, ready to give help and to receive it, our meeting can be a channel for God's love and forgiveness. To that, I can only add, Amen.